December the 19th, 1978. Not many more Tuesday nights this year. Well, tonight we are ready to begin on chapter 10 of Joshua. Still going on with this interesting story of Israel taking the land. They've been doing a pretty good job so far. Of course, there's prophecy that someday in the future they will enter the land again, as they did here in the book of Joshua. A miraculous entrance. Angels will go out and gather them from the four corners of the earth and bring them together, the great ingathering. In fact, that great ingathering is a little bit like the Feast of Tabernacles. All right, chapter 10, Joshua, page 303. Now it came to pass that Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem, had heard how Joshua had taken Ai and had utterly destroyed it, as he had done to Jericho and her king, so he had done to Ai and her king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them. But they feared greatly, because Gibeon was a great city, as one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all the men thereof were mighty. So, this man, Adoni-Zedek, is getting a little worried. It wasn't so much when it took Jericho, but when it took Ai, coming along. And so he's scared. Now we'll see what he'll do about it. Verse 3. Wherefore, Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem, sent unto Hoham, king of Hebron, none to Piram, king of Jarmuth, none to Jasha, king of Lachish, none to Deborah, king of Eglon, saying, come up unto me and help me, that we may smite Gibeon, for it have made peace with Joshua and with the children of Israel. Oh, he isn't going to fight Israel. He's going to fight Gibeon because he feels that if they had sort of left them and gone over on the other side. Now that is the plot. And here are these other kings that he's going to work with. Now keep in mind here that this Jerusalem has never been taken by the Israelites yet, and this story is being written, and never was taken really until David took it. Verse 5. Therefore the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, the king of Eglon, gathered themselves together and went up, they and all their hosts, that is their armies, and encamped before Gibeon and made war against it. So, here is the setting. Of course, now when they encamp, why they set up and try to cut off all folks going in and out, so on, and hope that either starve them out or break the walls down or do something to win over them. And the men of Gibeon sent unto Joshua to the camp to Gilgal, saying, slack not thy hand from thy servants. Come up to us quickly and save us and help us. Now, as we read in here, well, I might as well finish that verse. For all the kings of Amorites that dwell on the mountains are gathered together against us. I was going to say that these Gibeonites do not seem to be particularly related to the Canaanites and the Amorites and so on in here, but a different people. It seems to indicate to us that since they did make a peace with Israel and did not go along with the others, that they were not of the false seed, those that were to be destroyed. And so it was arranged in such a way that they escaped the slaughter that Israel made in this land when they took it. Now in verse 7, so Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of them. And the Lord said unto Joshua, fear them not, for I have delivered them into thine hand, there shall not a man of them stand before thee. Joshua therefore came unto them suddenly, and went up from Gilgal all night. And the Lord discomfited them, that is, the five kings, before Israel, and slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, and chased them along the way that goeth up to Beth Horon, and smote them at Azekah and at Makeda. We have our map here, and I suspect it wouldn't be a bad idea if I would just point out a little bit of this. Get up here and point some of this on the map. Gibeon is right over here, and Ai is over here right next to Bethel. Now, this Makeda is still over here almost on the coast, right below Ekron. So from Gibeon, they're over to here, according to the scale of miles on here, they must have chased them at least 20 miles, maybe 25 miles. That gives us an idea of the run that they had, going almost straight west from Gibeon. Now, Gibeon is just a few miles from Jerusalem. I would say less than 10 miles. It's north and a little bit west of Jerusalem. Folks who have their maps can check out on these, but I tried to find all of these 31 kings, their cities, in my maps, and none of my atlases or anything seemed to have all of them, because, for one thing, they're not sure where all of them were. Some of them are so completely erased that probably they haven't even found ruins yet. But a great many of the cities have been uncovered, and they have been identified. Now, verse 11. And it came to pass, as they fled from before Israel, and were in the going down to Beth Horon, that the Lord cast down great stones from heaven upon them at Azekah, and they died. They were more which died with hailstones than they whom the children of Israel slew with a sword. Now, if we were to carefully study this and get the time and so on, we'll find that this was about in the month of July. Now, there might be rain, there might be hailstones back in the month of Nisan, which would be around our April, and there might be some more coming later on in maybe in September. But in July, a rain and even hail was something just unheard of. And so here is something that is, in more than one way, a miracle. Of course, now, that we are supposing that these were ice, chunks of ice, we call them hailstones. They could have been meteorites. And there are some who think that they were. A shower meteorite shell. Small pellets, and a lot like bullets, they mowed the folks down. Well, that wouldn't be out of the ordinary either, because that sort of thing has happened, and there have been a lot bigger ones than that for them. In fact, we have in our own United States where a meteor hit the earth and tore a hole in the earth pretty close to a mile and a half long. And down in the Carolinas, if you look from the air, you can see a whole bunch of, looks like potholes, or dried up lake bed, where meteors at one time showered on their large ones. And remember that some 40 years or more before this, that they had had a similar thing happen in Egypt, one of the plagues of hail. And it's rather likely at the time of the year, and the way the description is, that these were meteorites or a shower of stones from a volcano, or something of the kind, because the earth cracked open and fire ran along the earth. There was lava flowing and destroying crops and trees and so on. So it was a terrific time. And there were tidal waves connected to that, according to other accounts. And that's one reason why that the Amalekites had left the Arabian Peninsula and were entering Egypt at that time, that Israel left, is because the tidal waves and the other plagues that came. There's more than on Egypt, but nearly every country in the world has. The aboriginals have stories concerning these plagues that happened on Egypt. It seems about the only place that escaped was that little land of Goshen down in Egypt for the Israelites. You read the account for yourself. It's rather interesting. Well, here it is. More are killed by these stones, whatever they are, came down from heaven. And the word heaven is plural. It means the clouds. So it came from the clouds. And more of them died from that than what the children of Israel slew with the sword. Then spake Joshua to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, Son, stand thou still upon Gibeon. And thou moon in the valley of Ajalon. And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed, and until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is not this written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and hasted not to go down about a whole day. About a whole day. It doesn't say a whole day, it says about a whole day. Now this is not unrecorded. Go back into the Egyptian astronomy, and they have in their record a day, an extra day. And in the calendars that they have, it would seemingly put in a double day. Now when you go forward to it, it ends with Tuesday. When you go back with it, it ends with Wednesday in their calendar. Just taking an extra day somewhere because the Tuesday and the Wednesday should have been the same day. Now there's a couple of things in here that are very interesting and significant. The sun was to stand right over Gibeon, neither to the east nor to the west, but right in what we call the zenith, the heaven. And the moon could be seen at that time of the day, and it was way west in the valley of Ajalon. Well, it must not have been a full moon, being over in the west. And in the daytime. Well, you can figure that, but I'll tell you what can be done. Astronomers can stand on those spots, and this valley of Ajalon is really a gunfight pass, very narrow, which makes it possible that this could happen, this conjunction of the moon and the sun in that position, happen about once. And so it takes us right back to about 1451, a little bit less. I've forgotten the exact date. I do remember that they figured it out as July 21st and 22nd. Astronomers can do that from their scientific instrument. Tell you when it happened. And there are stories concerning this all over the world. People knew about it in all the lands. About this day. It was almost an extra day. Now they have a story over in Hawaii. And there they have one of their heroes who fixed a net. And he threw it and caught the sun and held it for almost a day. And so now, when you see the sun's rays shining, looking like a string or something like that, that's the net for this hero of Hawaii. I've forgotten his name. I haven't looked at this for a long time. I have seen various theories, pictures, and so on. I've seen one some time back that showed how the earth might twist in its motion without stopping. And could twist in this motion and keep that same position for almost a day. Well now, I'm not too interested in how it was done. I'm interested in the fact that it was done. And another thing that's interesting is that our astronomers know now from the records they have that this wasn't quite a day. It lacked 40 minutes of being a day. And that's another point that comes up. And way back, oh, some 80 years ago or something like that, in England, we have this story about an astronomer talking about this, and a young fellow said, well, he says, you can show me where that other 40 minutes is from the Bible. He said, I think I can believe the Bible. And so he just pointed him to the place where the story of Hezekiah, and he had this boil, or whatever you want to call it, on his neck. He was almost ready to die, and God gave the prophet a prescription for it. He was to put a poultice of figs on his neck, and he was told he'd live another 15 years. And so Hezekiah kind of wanted a sign on that. And so he went into sundial of Ahaz and looked at it, and the shadow turned back 15 degrees. So that takes care of the other 40 minutes, because today the earth is just off one day from what it was before this long day of Joshua. Now, even with the scientific faction, you find that the Bible verifies science. Some people try to put it around the other way, but there's no need to do it that way. The Bible never needs verifying. It just needs a little understanding sometimes. But it gave them an extra 12 hours at least of daylight. That is the point. That they could avenge themselves upon their enemies. They could finish the job with the sword. And there was no day like that before it or after it, that the Lord hearkened unto the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. No, there's no record anywhere that anything like this ever happened before that or after it. Now, of course, when we start looking into science, and we know that the earth revolves on its axis, that ordinarily, if the earth were put on the brakes and stopped, it had twisted all to pieces, and the oceans had overrun the land, and so on. Now, just tomorrow knowledge is a science, but of course God has everything in his hands, and he can do it, and he can put his hand on the earth and stop it, and not have those things happen either. Well, it is a great miracle. I don't pretend to explain it. I've had science, I've read a great deal about this, or other folks have their ideas about it and so on. But I just take it that's what the Bible says here, that the sun apparently stopped moving. That's apparently, because it looks to us like the sun moving. And stood still for a long time. And then finally evening set in. Gave Israel a chance to fight. And Joshua returned, and all Israel with him unto the camp to Gilgal. But these five kings fled. They just left their armies and skipped, and hid themselves in a cave at Makeda. As I said a while ago, that was almost over to the coast, west of Gibeon. And it was told Joshua, saying, the five kings are found hid in a cave at Makeda. And Joshua said, roll great stones upon the mouth of the cave, and set men by it for to keep them. And stay ye not, don't stop there, but pursue after your enemies, and smite the hindermost of them. Suffer them not to enter into their cities, for the Lord your God hath delivered them into your hand. That must have been a terrific rout. They chased them so fast they couldn't even get to their cities and get in them. So Israel were after them. And it came to pass, when Joshua and the children of Israel made an end of slaying them with a great slaughter, till they were consumed, that the rest which remained of them entered into the fenced city. There weren't very many left. And all the people returned to the camp to Joshua at Makeda in peace. None moved his tongue against any of the children of Israel. I want you to notice that. That's a little Hebrew idiom. None moved his tongue against any of the children of Israel. That shut the enemies up. They were afraid. here having an extra day, and Israel fighting against such odds, against five nations, really, five kings, and routing them sort of like that and so on, really subdued them. Now let's see here. I lost my place. Yeah, that's right. I just did 21, that's right. And then moved his tongue against any of the children of Israel. Then said Joshua, open the mouth of the cave, and bring out those five kings unto me out of the cave. And they did so, and brought forth those five kings unto him out of the cave, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon. And it came to pass, when they brought out those kings unto Joshua, that Joshua called for all the men of Israel, and said unto the captains of the men of war, which went with him, come near, put your feet upon the necks of these kings. And they came near and put their feet upon the necks of the men. And Joshua said unto them, fear not, nor be dismayed. Be strong and of good courage, for thus shall the Lord do to all your enemies against whom you fight. And afterward, Joshua smote them, killed them, and slew them, and hanged them on five trees. Notice, hanged them after they were killed. That was Israel's way of doing. They didn't hang people up to let them die. And they were hanging upon the trees until the evening. And it came to pass the time of the going down of the sun that Joshua commanded, and they took them down from off the trees and cast them into the cave wherein they had been hid, and laid great stones in the cave's mouth, which remain unto this very day. There's this expression again, this very day. Now that was at the time of writing on Joshua. Don't go there and look for them now. Not likely to find them. Now I want to stop here just a moment here for something else and show the map just a little bit. But and those of you who listen, get out your maps that you have, or Bible Atlas or whatever, and see if you can find some of these things too. When Israel came over here to enter the land, they came down over part of the Dead Sea and up in here to right across from Jericho. However, here was a country here right east of the upper part of the Dead Sea, which Reuben later on took. And that was held by the Ammonites. And remember, the Ammonites would not at the first let them go through there. And so they went on around that. And above them was the country of Gilead. And that was, I kept Moab down here first. It's where the first hit. I got that wrong. Moab wouldn't let them go through. And Ammon did. They had to go around Moab, which is right east of the lower part of the Dead Sea. Now I'm getting my bearings here. I hadn't looked at this. And they went into the country of the Ammonites, and that took them right over near to the Jordan River, and you find that Gilead, the country, is right north of the Ammonites, and that takes you on up into the headwaters of the River Jordan, way up to Dan, and the waters of Merom, and the Sea of Galilee all on the west side of that. And that was the country of Bashan. Now this map I'm showing right here doesn't have Bashan on it, but it's right here, right where my hand is, Bashan. Now, King Og was king of Bashan. He was a giant, a great giant, giant king. He was some of the Nephilim, or the seed of the evil one. And over here is Golan, what's it called, the Golan Heights now. And all of this country here, clear from out of the headwaters up the dam of the Jordan River, clear down to the border of Moab, and up off the middle of the Dead Sea, Israel took before they crossed into take Jericho. That's why I wanted to get across. And so this part that Ammon had, Reuben finally took, because they finally did have to take care of the Ammonites. And then this Gilead part here was taken over by the tribe of Gad. And then above that, going up to, well, there's a river here called Yarmouth, but there's another name for it, I think, in some of your Bibles, and I've forgotten the long name. But above that was a half-tribe of Manasseh. Now, Manasseh had two different inheritances. They took one on the east side, and also took the a portion on the west side of the Jordan over to the Mediterranean Sea, and Samaria was almost in the midst of that, which of course became years and years later the capital of the ten tribes who were holy. That gave you a little bit of an idea of what was going on here. Now, when we go into the land here at Jericho, they went up to Ai, which is just a few miles near Bethel. In fact, from Jericho to Ai is about 8 miles, probably, according to the map. But by the time we get through with this, we go clear up here to Dor, D-O-R, which is up near Mount Carmel, and even beyond, and clear down over to let's see, Debir and Madon and some other names that's down here, almost to the bottom of the Dead Sea. So there was a long stretch there, which we really call Palestine now, on both sides of the Jordan and so on, which were allotted to these 12 tribes. Now, if you look at a map where it gives you the promised land to Israel when they went in, now I'm not talking about the promised land to Abraham, but I'm talking about the promised land to Israel, because the land that was promised to Abraham was several times as big as what Israel went in here to take. The land promised to Abraham was to come later. Right up in here, in the top of the map, up above Manasseh, is some rivers which are the beginnings of the Euphrates River. Now, a lot of people never realize that the Euphrates River lay right directly north of Jerusalem. Well, that was the beginning of it. And it ran into a southeasterly direction, and right after the Chaldees, Babylon, so on, into the Persian Gulf. Now, in the land of promise, that was the north and the east boundaries. And of course, then down to the Red Sea and clear over to the Nile River on the other side. So that would take it up to what we call modern, what is the name for Phoenicia today? I'm going to tell you the word and it didn't come to me. Well, that's up around Tyre and Zarephath and Sidon and so on up in there. They're coming to me for a while. That's a little map study, and we should do that, because this can all be in a haze if we don't look at the map once in a while and get some idea of where all this is happening. Now, we're down to verse 28. And this word Makeda comes up again, which, as I said, was over on the coast and fairly well north. And that day Joshua took Makeda and smote it with the edge of the sword. And the king thereof, he utterly destroyed them and all the souls that were therein. And he let none remain. And he did to the king of Makeda as he did unto the king of Jericho. Now, you'll go right on through here. And you will find king after king and city after city. And it does the same thing to all of them. Now, starting in the verse, or chapter 11, and we have a little bit more of it. Now, it came to pass when Jabin, king of Hazor, had heard these things, that he sent to Jobab, king of Madon, and to the king of Shimron, and to the king of Arsheth, and to the kings that were on the north of the mountain, of the plains south of Chinneroth, and in the valley, and in the borders of Dor on the west. Now that's a lot of territory. Almost the length of the country. And to the Canaanites on the east, and on the west, Canaanites were right along the Jordan River. That's the reason why it says on the east and on the west. On the east and west sides of the Jordan. And to the Amorite, and the Hittite, and the Perizzite, and the Jebusite, in the mountain, and to the Hivites under Hermon in the land of Mizpah. And Hermon is away north too. It looks like that the whole country now is rising up against Israel. He's licked these five kings here. They were seen to be minor, and now he's really getting something. And they went out, and all their hosts with them, much people, even as the sand was on the seashore, and multitude, with horses and chariots, very many. And when all the kings were met together, they came and fished together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. Now Merom is north of the Sea of Galilee. And the last time we heard of Joshua and his army, they were over east or west of that a little bit south, over practically on the coast. Of course, it's not a long way across there. But they're going to get together and fight against Israel. And the Lord said unto Joshua, be not afraid of them, for tomorrow about this time will I deliver them up all slain before Israel. And thou shalt husk their horses and burn their chariots with fire. Now today we wouldn't use that word husk their horses. We call hamstring the horses. And if anybody has difficulty about that, it cripples the horses so they'll never mount anything. It's severing the hamstring, that is, in the back of the back feet. And so the horses can't walk, which means they'd soon die. They didn't bother about killing the horses, but just cutting with their swords, and the horses would soon die. And they burned the chariots with fire. So evidently the chariots were wooden at that time. Well, I remember we used to use the wooden wagons with steel tires on them when I was a youngster on the farm. So Joshua came, and all the people of war with him, against them, by the waters of Merom suddenly. And they fell upon them. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel, who smote them, and chased them unto great Zidon, and unto Misrephothim, and unto the valley of Mizpah, eastward, and they smote them until they left them none remaining. And Joshua did unto them as the Lord bade him. He hucked their horses and burnt their chariots with fire. And Joshua at that time turned back and took Hazor, and smote the king thereof of the sword of Hazor before the time of his king, head of all these kingdoms. And they smote all the souls that were therein with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. And there was not any left to breathe. And he burnt Hazor with fire. And so then we go on down verse 19, it does say this, there was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel, save the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon. All other they took to battle, in battle. And here's the reason. For it was of the Lord to harden their hearts, that they should come against Israel in battle, that he might destroy them utterly, and that they might have no favor, but they might destroy them as the Lord commanded Moses. Well, now, I suppose at first sight that looks a little bit cruel, doesn't it? Think of God doing that. But when you figure what kind of people these are, that they're a mixed breed, half men and half demons, if you want to say that, that's what, where their origin was at least. And not only that, but they were so utterly idolatrous and engaged in a worship that we cannot describe, excepting just to say this, that venereal diseases were rampant among them, even among young children, as they're digging up and finding remains today in that part of the country. No wonder that the Lord wanted them killed so that they might not to infect the whole world. And Israel here was doing the job. And verse 21, at that time came Joshua and cut off the Anakims from the mountains, from Hebron, from Debir, from Anab, and from all the mountains of Judah, and from all the mountains of Israel. Joshua destroyed them utterly with their cities. There were none of the Anakims left in the land of the children of Israel, only in Gaza, in Gath, and Ashdod. And that, of course, is what we know as Philistia now, or Philistine. And, of course, I think most of you folks have looked at the Gaza Strip and so on in recent events in the last few years. And these are near there. Now, Gath, you can remember that the giant Goliath came from Gath in later years when David delivered Israel. So there is a a name that you can remember. So there was just a few of them remaining. Now you'll find later on in the Chronicles and Kings why that not all of them were slain. God said he left a few of the Canaanites to test Israel to see whether to obey him or not. Now, he wasn't too sure they would obey, was he? So Joshua took the whole land according to all the Lord said unto Moses, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance unto Israel according to their divisions by their tribes, and the land rested from war. I went ahead a little while ago and showed what was done on the east side. See, that was done out of the Jordan. That was done under Moses, the taking of the king of Bashan and the Moabites and the Ammonites and so on. And so in chapter 12, we start a little explanation of that. Now these are the kings of the land with the children of Israel smote and possessed the land on the other side of Jordan toward the rising of the sun from the river Arnon unto Mount Hermon. Arnon is south, Mount Hermon is toward the north, and all the plain on the east. Sihon, king of the Amorites, who dwelt in Heshbon, and ruled from Aroer, and so on. Now we have a list of these, which we don't need to go through here. Verse 7, and these are the kings of the country, which Joshua and the children of Israel smote on this side Jordan. And then down in verses 9 through 24, you have the 31 of the kings and their cities named, which Joshua and his armies, the Israelites, destroyed. There was not all of them destroyed the cities, like they did especially Jericho, which was burned with fire, and Ai, but they killed all the people and took all of the wealth and everything that they had, including the livestock and so on. Now, later on, Israel did live in many of these cities, and of course that was what was promised, that they could live in houses they had not built. And so that is what they did. They took over this land. Now, starting in chapter 13, now Joshua was old and stricken in years, and the Lord said unto him, thou art old and stricken in years, and there remaineth yet very much land to be possessed. And so he gives orders what they're to do, and how to divide it up. Now, we won't go into all of that. The time is about up anyhow. And if you want to read how it's divided, read the rest of that chapter 13. And also look at your map, because many of the maps give you the portions of the tribes and where they would be. Now, it is true that there was no land given to the tribe of Levi. You'll hang that down in 13:14. Only unto the tribe of Levi he gave none inheritance. The sacrifices of the Lord, God of Israel, made the fire are their inheritance, as he said unto them. And so he goes on and names the different tribes and where were to be. Now, I think this is probably what all we need to do with the book of Joshua. I really didn't think of going quite this far when we started. My lesson really was concerning the failure at Kadesh Barnea, and then how they overcame by going over and taking Jericho. But the story got so interesting, and there's so many things in here that needed to be given, that I went on with it. So now we will end this particular lesson here. Well, if I watch my time, I can go on. We had last week, we had some questions, and we covered a part of them. I was rather surprised we didn't get over the whole bunch, but when I get started on questions, usually more questions coming up until the thing balls up like a snowball. Now, the next question that I had on the list, the last one we had last week, was Colossians 3:4, all we know about hope. And so the next one after that is Well, when will Christ be manifested in the heavens? At the end of the ages, with all the redeemed? Well, now, we just had that question about Colossians 3:4, and that is our hope to be manifested with him when he is manifested. In other words, that'll be the time of the resurrection of the church, which is the body of Christ, and of which he is the head. Now, at what time? I don't find anything that tells me exactly what time. But there is a little principle that runs through the Bible that's helpful a little bit. And that is the one, the last shall be first, and the first shall be last. We know something about two other resurrections besides this one. The resurrection of Israel is one, and then finally the nations, which are dealt with first in the first 11 chapters of Genesis, and spoken of as being given up in Romans 1, 18 to 32. These nations come up at the great white throne judgment. So we have two of them, and those two, we know the order, that there's a 1,000 years difference between them. There's a 1,000 years difference between Israel's resurrection and the resurrection of the nations at the great white throne. So then, according to this rule, the church would have its resurrection and manifestation then before Israel has her resurrection. That is, at the seventh trumpet, at the end of the Great Tribulation. Now, there is a very significant thing that happens, spoken of in various places in the Scriptures. The Old Testament speaks of Satan having fallen from heaven, prophetic. The Lord said to his disciples after they had been out and having a success in their going from village to village and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom of heaven, he said, I beheld Satan fall as lightning from heaven. That's prophetic again. And we have it a third time in Revelation 12, 9th verse. And there we have warfare in heaven, and Michael is in charge of the angelic forces, and Satan and his armies fight, and Michael and his forces throw Satan and his armies out of the heavens into the earth. Now there is fulfilled what we find in Old Testament, and what the Lord said, so on. So that is a great event. As far as the universe, the creation is concerned, that doesn't particularly have too much to do maybe with the heavenly places, except even possibly in this way. And when that happens, at then Christ will be manifested with the church in the heavenly places. Now, there's another reason why that this must happen before the Great Tribulation is finished, or Christ comes, is because when he comes, he has many crowns, which is a Hebrew way of saying the great crown, the greatest of all. The greatest crown ever will be and ever has been. A King of kings and Lord of lords. King of all the kings of the earth. And so there was a coronation ceremony somewhere that he received this before he comes to the earth. And so possibly right around the time of the casting of Satan down out of the firmament or heavens above us into the earth and can't get back anymore. But that would be about the time of the manifestation of Christ. That would be about 3.5 years then before his coming to the earth, the parousia, or the apocalypse, as we would say. Now, I say just we're making those deductions from what we see in the Scriptures. Now, it's possible that as we study and so on, there'd be more things to either help verify this, or we might find something else different. We always leave the back door open so we can slip out, you know, on questions like this. The question here speaks about with all the redeemed. Well, now all the redeemed will not be manifested with him in the heavens, because there will be those who have been manifested here on the earth with him, that is, and his apocalypse are unveiled. That's just another way of saying a manifestation To manifest, the word manifest means to shine forth in glory, in case you missed that. And evidently Christ is hid in the heavens right now, because we're told that our life is hid with Christ in God. And if he's to be manifested someday in the heavenly places, then evidently he's not manifested there now. So if anybody went to heaven and looked around, he wouldn't be able to see him. He's there, visible. But he'd be made visible. And that will be at the time when he assumes his headship of the heavenly beings, principalities, powers, might, and dominions, and the church, which is foretold in Ephesians 1, 9, and 10, where we're given the mystery of God's will. And that is that in the fullness of times, the fullness of seasons, that Christ will be made head both of things on earth and things in heaven, which is his church, which is his body on earth, and of these principalities and powers in the heaven. And we have other places where the church is associated with these, and they're spoken of as the family of God, and the church becomes a part of it, and so on. So